First one is by Ariel Colonomos, who is a research fellow at the Centre National of la Recherche of CNRS, basically. The discussant is Pasquale Pasquino, who is a global distinguished professor in law and politics at NYU and the director de recherche at the CNRS. And Stéphanie will chair.
Well, first of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me to such a challenging conference on such an interesting and novel topic. As you can see, the title slightly differs from the one that is written on the program, and it's more precise. And let me begin by saying a few words about my own approach to this challenging and mysterious concept of collective wisdom. I think it differs from the notion that has been elaborated in the presentations that have been given so far, which several times I've equated collective wisdom to collective intelligence. Collective intelligence is one of the aspects that I've developed. You see the first one, but there are other definitions of collective wisdom that I'm going to work on in the presentation. The reason why maybe there are other approaches to collective wisdom is also maybe because of the specificity of international relations. At least I've discovered working on rereading some classical texts of international relations that wisdom and collective wisdom might be an implicit notion in those texts, although it's not explicitly elaborated. And I've discovered at least new things from IR that I hadn't seen previously. So here are the five sort of path leading to collective wisdom. So the correctness of the decision. Collective wisdom is also about making judgment, normative judgments. For example, George Bush Sr., at the eve of the first Gulf War, says this is a just war. He makes a judgment. He makes a normative judgment. And that's the third one. I think it's an interesting issue for international relations, signal, images, indexes. I mean, there are many people in IR who have worked on this, and I think that wisdom and collective wisdom can be an interesting signal that you send it on the international scene. The fourth dimension, this is maybe a more classical one, is that collective wisdom is part of several international traditions. Traditions carries some wisdom, or at least sometimes they do. And again, in international relations, and Daniel was mentioning this yesterday, theory and practice intermingle. If there is a field of social sciences where really, I mean, there's an overlapping between theory and practice, it's international relations. And you have traditions, and we'll discuss two of them, two very classical ones, that is realism and liberalism, and they have their own vision of what wisdom, individual and collective wisdom, is. And then the fifth dimension is something, again, that we mentioned this morning. It's a collective wisdom being part of a learning process. And here, I mean, this is to me an important aspect of what I study in this paper, because I'll focus on, at least in some parts, on time and the issue of pace, hasty decision, or slower ones. Again, for IR, a very interesting issue when you want to make a decision. What is a right international decision? There are two aspects. An international decision to be right has to be efficient, and also it has a normative value. That's the two meanings of rightness. And those decisions are practical decisions. And you don't need to be a theorist to do that. I mean, at some point, you want to give foreign aid or not. You want to declare war or not. But at the same time, those decisions, again, the two aspects are embedded. Those decisions are sometimes or are some implicitly or explicitly grounded on theory. Again, I mean, many practitioners are labeled as realists or liberal. Think about Henry Kissinger, for example. George W. Bush, again, would belong to the tradition that I won't explore, but he also belongs to a tradition. You might think he's not a theorist, but again, I mean, implicitly, that's what he does. And so they're grounded on a theory that might be wise or unwise, and that remains to be discussed. So the main question that I focus on is about the question of size. I have learned, reading a little bit about collective wisdom, that this is an issue. I mean, to what extent does size has an impact on the quality of a decision? The bigger the wiser, the smaller the wiser, there are several options. So as far as international relations are concerned, and as far as the theory of international relations are concerned, and then when you study empirical cases, what are the questions that I want to raise? First of all, the specificity of international actors. The international scene, as you know, is a very heterogeneous field. You have a multitude of actors that differ on status and on size. Are there international actors that, depending on their size, are wiser than others? Does it make a difference in terms of wisdom? This is a very, I would say, sort of implicitly classical question of IR. Then, and that's something that I want to stress, the specificity of international relations, it's about the relations. It's about relationships. When you study international relations, you study interaction. That's why also my paper might slightly differ from the other papers, which are focused on the internal and domestic aspect of the group. Here, what I focus on is the group vis-à-vis other players. You're not alone in international relations. And therefore, are there entities whose interaction with other units would create a wiser international scene? That's an obsession for IR. What is the best international system you can get? And what is the criterion you will use in order to determine what's best? And the third question is a recurring theme in the paper, is are there levels of practice in international an interaction that are better than others? For example, when you play in a unilateral game or in a multilateral one, does it make a difference? And again, here you have normative preferences. I mean, authors and actors differ. I mean, have different views on this. So what are the tradition, the models that I will explore? Well, as I said, I mean, I will discuss realism. This is maybe the most classical school of thought in international relations. And, of course, realism parallels practice in IR, which is realpolitik. I will discuss liberalism. And here, when I mention liberalism, it's to make it simpler. What I intend here to say is that it's liberal internationalism. And I say a few words about, I'm sure you know what this is, but I'll say a few words about it later. So I will discuss their vision of wisdom, whether it's implicit or explicit. And I will consider these two practical options, which are unilateralism and multilateralism. So I will follow a three steps analysis. The first one is about the wisdom of traditions and their definitions of collective wisdom, namely in realism and in liberalism. Then I will move on to case studies, and I have chosen. I will study the use of coercion, which is fairly classical aspect of international relations, and I will discuss two types of coercion, the first one being economic coercion through embargoes, and the second one being the use of force, and a specific type of use of force, which is the preventive use of force, if I have enough time to develop it. And then I'll move on to a third aspect, a third level, which is a systemic one. At the level of the international system, what are the most appropriate modes of interaction you can imagine? This is a normative forecast in order for the system to be wiser. So, realism. Realism are not modest, they're fairly ambitious, and they consider that their tradition is wise. When you read and when you study realism, there's a very important author that is always mentioned, that is maybe the sort of grounding father, what is considered to be the grounding father of the discipline by the realists, and that is Thucydides. And it's interesting here, I mean, to make this connection with the Greeks, because, I mean, the topic here is wisdom. And I'm not saying that that is a realist. I mean, this did not exist. Realism did not exist at the time of Thucydides, but IR scholars like to refer to Thucydides for many reasons. And Thucydides puts an emphasis on prudence, and that realists, they like it a lot because they consider that the decision in international politics has to be prudent. You don't have to be hasty. You have really to calculate. Calculus is a very important aspect of realism. You have to calculate what are the consequences when you want to pursue your national interest and maximize your power, which is the goal which is what states do and which is what states should do according to realism. A very important question that Thucydides and realists raise is, well, what is the best collective entity? And here I will equate best to wisest, because it is the entity that should produce the best decision. And here, implicitly, there are people who argue in favor of this interpretation. When Thucydides discusses the opposition between Sparta and Athens, well, it shows, I mean, he considered that maybe Sparta might be a better political unit when it fights a war. Why? Because Sparta is an authoritarian regime, and Athens is a democracy where passions prevail. And that realists do not like it at all. They want people to be rational, and the few here are better than the many. It's better to have few autocrats than many decent democrats. Realism gives a negative definition of wisdom, Thucydides and realism. You have to avoid softness. The fear of realists and Thucydides is passivity. You don't want to send the image on the international system that you're passive, because you're going to be, it's going to be interpreted as a weakness, and then this, another state will attack you. But you don't want to send the message that you are full of hatred, because you become dangerous and people, other states will bandwagon and neutralize you. So there's a certain wisdom of the fabric of images. Realism is about predicting the future. And here, this wisdom is not necessarily grounded on science. Morgenthau, one of the leading authors, states it clearly well. I mean, it's an art. It's an art of politics. It's a lot about intuition here. What about one of realism's main opponents, liberalism? Well, liberalism, there's a little bit of a symmetry between realism and liberalism, liberal internationalism, whereas in realism you have this sort of negative ontology, here in liberalism it's a little bit the opposite. Here you trust men. To a certain extent, you're fairly optimistic. You have this goal, ambitious goal, which is the advancement of humanity. And cosmopolitanism is your normative framework and also practical framework. Wisdom in liberalism is rooted in morality. You make appropriate judgments on the modalities of cooperation. You want to build the most appropriate framework in order for the politics of cooperation to happen. Liberal internationalism focuses on laws and norms. And here it's an interesting point. You see the difference in terms of their interpretation of size and decision. Whereas in realism, the state is the best unit. And sometimes the autocrats within the states this is the best unit in order to provide wise decision. Within liberal internationalism framework, the most appropriate framework and size are international organizations, multilateralism, and of course they know that international organizations there's certain inertia. And therefore, procedures slow down the process. However, this is not something bad. On the contrary, procedures slow down hasty and dangerous decisions, whereas for realism, you have to be quick. There's really a symmetry. Liberalism is also about softness, a softness of morality, soft power which morality which should temper the harshness of the law and the harshness of politics. And if you want in the discussion, I can elaborate more on this. So the coercion, of course, is one of the main aspects of international relations. International relations being a game of power, although morality and law do play a role, but it's mostly a priori a game of power. And economic sanctions are one of the aspects of using power in international politics. And here I will discuss two types of sanctions: unilateral sanctions and multilateral sanctions. I've chosen a very classical example from the history of embargoes, which is the U.S. embargo against Cuba, a very long-standing embargo, which is still today, look at the campaign in the United States, an issue. An electoral issue. Obama was sort of was criticized because he made some moves in order maybe either to soften or to lift the embargo. It's very risky for a U.S. president to do that. So what is interesting with this case is that although the threat of communism had disappeared, the embargo has been strengthened twice in 1992 and 1996. Everyone knows, and especially our American friends, why. It's because of the power of the lobby of the Cuban American National Foundation and because of the power they have in terms of votes in Florida and New Jersey, and maybe in some other states. So they achieved their goal. Actually, they wrote the law. They paid someone to do it, and the Helms-Merton law and the Torricelli law has been written by the Cuban American National Foundation. This is really a dysfunctional decision, totally dysfunctional. It's inefficient on the target. It's economically costly for the sender. I mentioned some studies in economics that assess the cost of the sanctions. It creates tensions between the U.S. and Europe because of legal issues. I skipped the details, but that's what happens. And it might cause humanitarian problems. Very slight. Not big humanitarian problem, but a problem is in sort of bringing some spare parts to some machines that are being used in the hospitals. That led President Clinton to make a normative judgment, and I think he was pretty wise to say that the U.S. had gone sanctions crazy. One of the reasons why, it's also because the Congress sort of took power, and the executive branch was sort of kidnapped and had to sort of be passive in front of the Congress that made foreign policy in terms of sanctions. What does this example tell us? It shows that the limits of democracy. It shows that the local imposes its will on the national and that small is not wise but stronger than big in this case. Here, this decision reflects the passions of small groups. Passions of small groups are stronger than the interests of a bigger collective. This is typically an unwise decision, which is past-oriented, which is fueled by resentment, and that is an obstacle to political, legal, and moral progress. What would have been the wisest decision? The wisest decision would have been to move to an upper level of analysis and practice, and to choose a totally different venue. It's multilateral cooperation would have been much wiser, would have been more efficient, would have sent a better image to the world, and it would have been also a sort of an optimist path that you want to follow, and also a very reasonable one. So here, liberal internationalism and multilateral cooperation would have been much better than this unilateral approach. My second example in terms of sanctions, it's multilateral sanctions, the other type of embargo, and here I will briefly discuss the case of the UN embargo against Iraq. Here, I just want to say something that multilateral sanctions clearly belong to liberal internationalism and to the tradition of international law in international relations. This was the perfect tool of foreign policy for President Woodrow Wilson, who was one figure in the history of liberal internationalism and international law. So the UN embargo against Iraq, as you well may know, is maybe the most catastrophic example of the use of economic sanction in the history of embargo. It has been a disaster in terms of its lack of efficiency and because of the humanitarian disaster that it has caused. What is interesting here in terms of decision making is to note that as soon as the embargo has been implemented, 1 year after, experts from the UN quickly made an assessment of the likely consequences of the embargo on Iraq in 1992. And they said to the UN headquarters, this is going to be a major humanitarian disaster. We're going to face this a very high increase in terms of mortality. And this has not been taken into account by the UN bureaucracy. Here you have the problem of the inertia of bureaucracy, games of power that are an obstacle to a wise decision. States that oppose to what would have been the best decision. It's a catastrophe in terms of mortality. I mean, the most conservative estimates of the increase of mortality are that had the embargo not been put in place, 227,000 children under 5 would not have died. And to that critique, Madeleine Albright had this answer on public television. I think, and it's interesting here for this conference, then she said, we think this is the price to pay. So this is really the art of politics and the art of diplomacy at its worst. However, it's interesting to see what the reaction has been within groups of experts. I mean, we have mentioned this issue of expertise several times. And here you see that wisdom is a learning process. After the failure of the Iraqi embargo, several experts, which were sponsored by states, Switzerland, well, neutral states, I mean, the good guys in international relations, Canada, I think Norway, and other, Sweden, I think, they sort of sponsored a study on what economic sanctions should be. And they came up with a reform in the doctrine of economic sanctions, that are called smart sanctions, that are focused, that are that target political leaders and do not harm the civilian populations. Here you see that the international system has a response to one of its failures, and this comes from small groups in this case. What do we learn from this example? We learn that the law is not that wise, and then multilateralism can really fail and can lead to a disaster. Big might be unwise. Why? Because there's a lack of coordination between a big organization which has many subunits. And here, really, liberal internationalism as a tradition has been more the problem than the solution. The liberal internationalism is considered to be sort of a nice approach to international politics, but it has its aspects of cruelty. And Woodrow Wilson has really some very harsh words when he spoke about economic sanctions. And realism here doesn't have much to say on this issue. As I see that I have only 8 minutes left, I think that maybe I will leave for the discussion the example of the preventive war, and feel free to ask me questions about the debate between unilateral approaches to war and multilateral approaches to war in the case of preventive war. I want to move on to the third aspect, the third part of the presentation, which is a third level of analysis, which is a systemic level of analysis. I want here to to raise the issue of collective wisdom in the international system as an output of the interaction between the different parts of the international system. And this would this enables me to go beyond the divide between realism and liberalism and unilateralism and multilateralism. So here what I want to do is to elaborate a social and normative forecast, a scenario. I don't mean to say that this is going to happen, but this might happen, and this, I think, would be an interesting thing for international relations if it were to happen. My approach to the international system here is an approach in terms of a multicentric world. That is, you have a world of states that interact one with another, and also you have another world, which is the world of non-state actors, which are very different one from the other. It's not homogeneous, and you have an interaction between the world of states and the world of non-state actors. And that's what is interesting, especially in post Cold War politics, is this heterogeneity of the international system and of international relations, which make them more turbulent and more unpredictable. So I imagine some ideal forms of interaction between these different players, and I move from the bottom I have a bottom-up approach. The starting point, and here I'm more optimistic than some of you who criticize experts or entrepreneurs in sort of fields such as law or NGOs. But I start with norms entrepreneurs and moral entrepreneurs and the work they do in the fabric of norms. My understanding of what they do is that those people, whether it's an NGO, whether it's a group of lawyers, they try to anticipate what in the future would be considered as a good norm, what will be accepted. Whether it's the environment, think about 20 or 30 years ago, whether it's whale fishing, or whether it's weaponry, they try to imagine how they can be pioneers in the development of an idea. And they bet on the potential cascading effects of the norms. There's an interesting example that several people in the international relations community have studied. It's the landmines campaign. How does this idea came up from the bottom to governments which had to ratify, at least some of them, a treaty? There's a cascading effect in international relations, the cascading effects of norms. This cascading effect is much more likely to happen when it's grounded on when ideas are grounded on established traditions and doctrines. And here in the paper, I make the example on just war theory, the way it is being reinterpreted in IHL, and then the way it is reinterpreted when advocacy networks make the case that you have to ban cluster bombs. And again, I'll be happy to answer to questions on this issue. In order for this cascading effect to develop, you have to look at the state-society relations. If state-society relations are favorable to the development of these ideas, and I take here the example of corporate social responsibility and the U.S. and at the level which moves at the level of the United Nations. In order for this virtuous circle to happen, you need interlocking members between the state and the non-state world. I call them moral epistemic networks. That is, people who are technicians who have an authority in a field and also who want to have moral authority because of the knowledge. And that's here in interaction between experts and governments. Those people want to seize a very precise moment, a right moment, when there is an opportunity in international relations so that you can develop this idea and you have to, people will gather around this idea. There are two paths that this idea can and should follow is a transnational path where you have mostly non-state actors and a transgovernmental space. There's a well-known American lawyer, Mary Slaughter, who argues there's a new world order because of the this transgovernmental space. You therefore create a new space for of deliberation between state borders. So let me now come to my conclusion. So I have shown in these different case studies that the bigger can be the wiser, but more probably the smaller is not the wiser. It really there is no general rule on this matter in international relations. The different examples are too diverse in order to for us to establish a rule. The question that my final answer to this is that in this third level, the systemic level, I have discussed the possibility of a virtuous circle to happen in order to have coalescence around a norm that eventually could be considered as a good norm. And this has led me to think about the concept of international community. I mean, here we have several lawyers. And international community is a terminology that is most often used by lawyers, at least some of them. I am fairly skeptical vis-a-vis the coherence and the strength of this notion. It's most often very much criticized by political scientists. The most common argument they use is that the international community is a social construction of reality, therefore the international community does not exist. Well, I think that the international community is a social construction of reality, but that doesn't mean that it does not exist. What I've shown here in this third part is that this circle is a wise moment, or could be a wise moment in international affairs. So therefore, here you have the issue of time. It's a very, very specific moment in the interaction between the different players. And this moment might be ephemeral. It precedes and follows chaos and turbulence, but that's what international community can be at its best.
Ariel's presentation, like his paper, was very clear, so I do not need to summarize it. I cannot either present any serious criticisms or objections, since international relations is not my research field, and, as you know, I believe in expertise. So I will simply ask some questions, trying as I can to connect his paper to our general conversation, inevitably from my own point of view. By the way, I have a small objection, not to you, but to the realists. I mean, it's not true at all, and I'm speaking from something I know, that Sparta was able to defeat Athens. Never. Moreover, the military organization of Athens was both based on the crucial role of the Demotic Navy, which stabilized the regime, and strategoi were elected. So it's much more... They don't understand exactly Athens, these guys. So wisdom of crowd, as we know now, is a vast sujet, a large topic. The crowd should be identified, according to my authority, the Oxford English Dictionary, with, I quote, a large number of persons contemplated in the mass. But more in general, we have been interested here in collective decision-making, not only of a large number of citizens as such, but also of representative, notably constituent assemblies, and even of the collective decision-making of small groups of experts, like specialists deciding about citizens' health as in Philippe Urfalino's paper, or in the case of courts deciding about constitutionally protected rights. Citizens as such, rational citizens, whatever rational means, and even experts have been the object of our conversation. Likewise, the procedures they do or should use in these small or large collective bodies in order to make wise decisions or alternatively correct predictions. Parenthetically, let me stress here en passant that correct predictions, X will be the American president, are analytically and actually different from saying X is the person who assassinated Y. We will know in general if the prediction was correct or not, if the US president will be Mr. X or the competitor. On the other hand, we may never know if a jury was right or wrong convicting Mr. X. And all that is different from some other decision, like choosing a presidential or a parliamentary system for a given country after a serious discussion in a constituent assembly. Parker Bruce Ackerman, we may think, and many do think, that the US presidential system is okay. Likewise, the German or the British parliamentary one. In the first two cases, there is one single good or right answer. In the last one, circumstances matter a lot. In Ariel's paper, the collective body of which we may predicate wisdom or the lack of it, and much depends evidently on our definition of wisdom, is the so-called international community. Inside the uncertain doctrine we call international public law, the members of this collective entity, or more precisely, the members of international organizations, are not individuals like in an electoral body, a representative assembly, or a constitutional court, but something named sovereign states. Sovereign states are sort of individual writ large who consider themselves and want to be considered fully autonomous. That means that they want to be free like the individual member of a republic where heteronomy doesn't exist. That seems to imply peculiar consequences I'll try to spell out, and these are also somehow questions to Ariel. In some contexts, the autonomy of the members of the international community is taken very rigidly. I have in mind the WTO, where any decision has to be made with the unanimous agreement of each single member. Voting or deciding under the shadow of the veto makes the decision very difficult. From the beginning of its existence, the WTO hasn't been able to this day to make any single collective decision, any new multilateral agreement. Which, by the way, doesn't mean at all, I want to be clear, that the organization has been ineffective. I personally believe the contrary, but for a variety of other reasons. It's a court also. It accepted that China joined the WTO, so it's a serious story. But they were never able in the last 12 years to pass a new agreement, which they should do. In some other contexts, for instance, the European Union, the member states are quasi or semi-sovereign and decided to use for the decision-making process what we call in French vote pondéré. Contrary to John Stuart Mill's opinion, we never accepted in the contemporary world to give two votes to a citizen, even if he's a member of the Collège de France. But it would be preposterous to give Germany and, say, Luxembourg the same weight in collective decision inside the European Union. Now, the mechanism of vote pondéré would not work and is not accepted in the WTO, since in that context not only they are sovereign and not semi-sovereign subject, but in WTO some few countries, the economic superpowers, would control always any decision. In fact, five member or so weight more in the international trade than all the other 135 members. So there will be, with the vote pondéré, a stable majority. Things are, again, different in the United Nations, as you know better than me. Here, some members are not like the others. I mean, they have a special voting weight. These are as known the winners of the Second World War plus France. They are really autonomous, at least in principle. In principle, because as we recently saw, a superpower may ignore de facto the veto of the other members of the Security Council. So to finish, it seems to me that one lesson of this conference is that the quality and the nature of the members of the collective bodies making decisions matter a lot, as well as the rule for the collective decision. One could add that some collective bodies are thick and some other thin. By this I mean that in some contexts the exit for those who do not agree is possible, whereas in other contexts the exit is either difficult or impossible. Moreover, some groups may postpone the decision on even not to decide, meaning to keep the status quo ante. Courts, instead, have to make decision to avoid the crime of déni de justice, denial of justice. But some courts have more time than others. The French Constitutional Council has to give its answers in less than 1 month, de facto 21 days. The German Constitutional Court, instead, has no mandatory time limits. A famous decision took 6 years of debates in the Bundesverfassungsgericht. As to wisdom, and I'm not speaking here of prediction, it is trickier. People disagree about what is wise, and again, I'm not speaking of prediction. There is a formal and a material definition of wisdom. I'm borrowing here the German legal language concerning what are statute laws. In the first case, the decision is wise because of the quality of the organ taking it. A law, a statute law in that sense, is good because made by the right subject, which has to make the law, the parliament, and according to some specific rules. In the second meaning, a law is right or a decision is correct because of its very content. But it's more difficult to agree concerning the second concept of wisdom. That is why I think, after all, that the type of intellectual exercise Jörn presented yesterday is worth pursuing, notwithstanding the important objection of Arnaud. Notably, I believe that the descriptive and normative analysis of collective decision-making rules is important in our context. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for these very wise comments and for sharing your knowledge and your approach of international politics and law with mine. Just a detail. It's not. There's a reading of Thucydides, which says that he would have favored Sparta and not Athens because he considered that Athens was too. It's a collective that was too passionate, and the expedition to Sicily is this example of a hasty and irrational decision. And I think it's Leo Strauss who has this reading.
Not by accident.
So the issue of experts and wise decision and predictions. Actually, in my initial paper, there was more about prediction, and I think this it's also why I was so interested in the discussion yesterday. Prediction is a fascinating field in international relations. That's a major epistemological question in international relations about the anticipating power of higher theory. And there's really a divide in international relations between people who say it's only an explanatory theory, and others say it's also a predictive one. And it's related to yesterday's session, it's a field where theory and practice intermingle, again, because you have scholars who work as consultants on the elaboration of predictions, and very, very serious ones. About the international community, well, the international community, to me, really, it doesn't exist per se. It's really an output. An output, have a normative vision of the international community, which is here a wise international community. And so it's really a moment in international relations. You're totally right, and you are much more knowledgeable than me on this issue about institutional design and the votes and veto in international bodies. And it's true, and I mentioned in the paper. I mean, it's not something that I want to elaborate in the paper because I'm not knowledgeable in this aspect, and also because I focused on relations instead of the function of the organization itself. But you're totally right, and there's a debate about the European Union, as you know, about the. It starts with Robert Dahl, who says, I mean, there's a democratic deficit in international organizations. And this is a major critique that he addresses to international organizations. They are too big, and there's a democratic deficit. And recent scholarships, someone such as Andrew Moravchik has argued that, no, there is no democratic deficit in the European Union. The institutional design is a very good one, and it's functional. The case of the UN, to me, is more interesting because it crosses my interest. And it's related to preventive war. Preventive war is something that realists do not like because they think that it's too adventurous. You cannot predict the consequences. But liberal internationalists are more adventurous actually. And you have a fringe of liberals who would say, well, maybe we would like to elaborate a doctrine of preventive war, but a multilateral preventive war. And a multilateral preventive war grounded on humanitarian reasons. And in order to do so, you need to have a reform at the UN. The UN, as it stands now, cannot work if you want to launch a preventive war. Humanitarian preventive war. First of all, because it will be a problem with international law. I mean, the war will be legal, but it will contradict certain principles of international law. And you would need several reforms that you're suggesting. The veto problem. I mean, if you still have a veto, I mean, it would be difficult to wage this kind of war. I think that a good way would be to have a majority rule and to increase the members of the Security Council, and to have a Security Council which will be more legitimate and which will include new states. And also, you would have to have a system of accountability, ex ante and ex post. And in order to do that, you would really need some institutional design.
By the examples that you give, because you've got one example of unilateralism leading to some moderately negative effects, and then you've got another example of multilateralism leading to really bad effects, followed by some belated changes which didn't seem to accomplish what they were supposed to do because Saddam Hussein was still in power a few years later and seemed comfortable until he was overthrown. So, I mean, it seemed like your claim was that multilateralism was better, but your examples didn't really seem to really compellingly show that. It seemed that there was, I mean, at least the scales were in balance at the end. It was unclear which had really done better overall, or, I mean, both had done badly, which had done worse. It's not too clear.
Well, which has done worse? It's clearly the embargo against Iraq, because when you go multilateral, the consequences of your action are going to be much more ample than if you go unilateral. I mean, the consequences, the bad consequences of the embargo against Cuba are fairly limited. It's of some concern for U.S. Business people. It has some cost, but it doesn't have a negative impact on Cuba. It doesn't have a positive one if you want to see the regime change. But it's not clearly not a good decision, but it's not a catastrophic decision. Whereas a multilateral decision, such as in the case of the Iraqi embargo, is a disaster because of its scale. But what I would say is that in the examples, I have suggested some alternatives. In the case of the Cuba unilateral embargo, a multilateral approach would have been better. It has not been. This has not happened because of power relations in the votes.
So all you're saying is that in that particular case, a multilateral approach would have happened to be better, but it isn't that you're claiming that multilateralism is in general better because of some wisdom of international crowds argument?
No.
Oh, all right.
Well, I want to talk about maybe the Thucydidean error which is the conclusion that an authoritarian regime has greater state and military capacity than a democratic regime. And I'm criticizing the Thucydidean era. And yes, Athens lost the Peloponnesian War, but it was either 13 or 23 years later that Sparta permanently collapsed. And Josh Ober points out that the Spartan military and foreign policy was extremely rigid and inflexible. And once you figured out their military strategy, they could be beat. And as a matter of fact, they were beat into submission by the Thebans and the Messenians who'd been studying them for years, and they never recovered. Now, you see the same. So I want to talk about a liberal democratic realism. You see the same thing for the question of England against the world. You had the spread of absolutism in Europe due in part to the perceived military and state capacity on the part of absolute monarchs. But after Dutch and English military successes, elites in Europe started saying, maybe we need republics too, or these people are going to beat us militarily. And then in the Cold War, you had the U.S. versus the USSR, and in I'm no great American partisan, believe me, but in the 1980s, you could read Solzhenitsyn over and over again about how the Americans are going to lose the Cold War. He sounded just like Thucydides. They're morally rotten because they're corrupted by luxury. They're corrupted by freedom. They don't know what it is to beg for bread. The Soviets will, it's a great tragedy of the modern world that the lights will go out because they don't have Spartan fortitude. And I'm borrowing from Stephen Holmes' argument about how the limited liberal democratic government is a stronger government for its limitation, stronger for three reasons, and this finishes it, greater wealth, greater knowledge and better decisions and greater flexibility as tendencies, not as absolute truths.
Yeah, maybe thank you very much. It's a very interesting question.
Well, comment, I'm sorry.
Actually, what Thucydides says and what people who read Thucydides say and what I would say is that it's a problem of decision within democracy when there's a military operation and you have to make a decision. And Thucydides makes the case that because of passions, you lose sight in terms of interest. Whereas if you have few people who are motivated only by interest, who are cold, impersonal, well, they would maybe make a better decision. But then what happens in the war and after the war is another issue. You might collapse for other reasons. You might collapse because of your lack of talent in the
imperial rule.
Yes, and also within your state, your lack of knowledge in terms of public policy, in terms of economics. But I don't want to say that authoritarian regimes always win. It's as you say, it's factually incorrect. But there's a certain sort of sympathy of realists vis-à-vis strong states. And when you have a strong state, well, you better have the few who really have power instead of having a sort of big bureaucracy.
But strong and authoritarian are not necessarily related.
No. I mean, you have strong democracies, of course. But think about Henry Kissinger, for example. Henry Kissinger, when he was going to the Middle East, was much more at ease in the Arab states than in Israel. Because in Israel, you have a democracy. Say, all those people are the crazy Jews. I mean, they fight one with the other. When you go to Sadat, I mean, you know that is the one who rules. And the same, Henry Kissinger...
There's advantages to unpredictability.
Yes, well, because that's one of realism goal, which is stability. You want to have people that are predictable. You don't like the unpredictable. That's one vision of international politics. And you don't like big organizations also because they're slow. Well, the same Henry Kissinger was saying, when I call Europe, what number do I dial? They want to have people to talk with and the people who make decisions because they focus on stability. The international system has to be stable.
Yes, my comment is in a way, or accidentally, a follow-up on that last remark. I'm going to introduce one concept of collective wisdom. I think it's related to what Ellen said earlier today about achieving Pareto optimal outcomes. And I'm going to suggest that in some cases, collective wisdom may require individual wisdom. And I want to choose an example from international politics, although there are many similar examples from domestic politics. And it's very simple. Often what we want is to achieve a good equilibrium and not to be trapped into a bad equilibrium. And often good equilibria are maintained by tit-for-tat strategies and fear of retaliation for defection. As in, for instance, the extent to which free trade is maintained may to some extent be a function of the fear of retaliatory protectionism. Now, for tit-for-tat to work, individuals, or in this case states, need to have a fairly long time horizon. Now, having a long time horizon is what I called yesterday in my presentation impartiality with across moments of time. Mm-hmm. So that's a form of wisdom, so individual states need to have wisdom in the sense of a long time horizon, for the system to have wisdom in the sense of ability to achieve a good equilibrium. It wasn't really a question, just a comment triggered by,
I think
the topic of your presentation.
I think it's a very interesting one, but I think then it depends if the governments consider that there's a continuity of the state. Because some leaders would say, après moi le déluge. think about, well, Bush and his friends. I mean, some people elaborate this scenario that Bush and his friends will strike against Iran between the elections and January because they just want to make this last blow. That's a contradiction of what you say, but what you say is wise, and those people are not wise. But.
So we're done, right?
Yes.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.